Good morning. The genesis of this study, as far as heating soil, normally we wouldn't want to go out and burn soil, and you'll find that kind of interesting, was we were contacted by a fairly large petrochemical company that had a little issue. And they were proposing to use thermal desorption as a method of remediation from hydrocarbons in a particular country, and that country had some concerns about it. So looking at the literature, the impact of fire, we often think of as probably a derogatory aspect in soil, and you start going through the journal publications, and most references will cite some pontificated theory of the past, but there really hasn't been a lot of very concrete indication of what actually occurs. Few recent publications are out, and even there, they're a little bit wishy-washy. We know that fire is commonly used in rangeland as a mechanism of liberating surface stover nutrients, quite often done. Although under those conditions, we often don't have the fuel load to really heat the upper surface very, very deeply. And that thermal desorption is a recognized method of removing hydrocarbons and other contaminants from soil. Our study objectives were really from the standpoint of if thermal desorption was used in a particular location, what impact would that have on the remediation of that soil back to native fauna there? So we took it from a standpoint of how do plant nutrient availability change following different heating regimes? What's the impact on pH, the liberation or potentially the sequestration of soil salinity aspects of it? The impact on water holding, because we figured there would be some physical modifications. And then we went into what is the impact, the near term, plus we're also working on the longer term impact on both emergence, germination emergence, and rooting development. Our approach was initially we could not import a particular soil because of multiple legal issues, both on U.S. side as well as the other country. So we chose a surrogate soil. It's a Kern clay loam. It's fairly unique for us in Texas. This happened to be a eroded soil, so we really were collecting the acid BT horizon. Why is it unique for us? Is that it is actually an ultisol. We don't have many ultisols, and it proved to be a great surrogate soil for this foreign soil that we could not import. At the same time, we chose two additional soils, the Westwood clay loam, one of our vertisols, in the Brazos Valley floodplain, along with a Raider. It's an upland alpisol, fairly sandy, once again, also low pH. I will note the unique thing about the Westwood, it is also a calcareous soil. We collected quite large quantities. We were doing this in conjunction with other laboratories and other entities for our grantor. And we air dried our soil initially and then oven dried at 65 degrees C for 3 days, 72 hours, just to facilitate better processing conditions. All the soils were hand sieved initially to remove large fragments, and then they were processed through a cone crusher that was set to a 5 millimeter opening, sieved once again, and then we put it through essentially an Agbice hammer mill, screened at 2 millimeters, and then that was entirely mixed using large cement mixers and multiple days. As we were waiting for some of the conditions for the main study, we decided we needed to get some preliminary work, and we chose a muffle furnace along with 24 by 14 by 6 centimeter stainless steel food steam table trays. Two of these trays were placed in a muffle furnace at temperature. After 1 hour, the trays that were essentially put in a crisscross configuration were pulled out, and they were reversed and then put back in for another hour. At the end of 2 hours of total heating time at temperature, they were pulled out and allowed to air cool. The process was repeated 3 times for each soil condition or its temperature. All that soil was then mixed. Our heating temperatures started out at 65 degrees. And then in 50-degree increments from 350 to 600 degrees, then we added 7 and 800 degrees C. As you can see, our catwalk for reducing some of the large we'll call them clods or peds, and to separate out the large coarse fragments. And on the right side, you'll see the muffle furnace, as well as a post removal of the cooling pans. We found some unique features. The top of the pans often did have appear to be void of any organic carbon, but through the bottom we did have a charcoalization aspect. And the unique aspect of this charcoal material was it was actually infused into the soil materials, that 2 millimeter and smaller material, instead of being as free charcoal like we would often expect if you were adding biochar mixed into soil. It was literally associated with the soil media. Our chemical soil analysis, naturally pH 2:1 for us, DI water to soil. We chose malic 3 for extraction of our primary and secondary nutrients, DTPA for the four major micronutrients, and these were analyzed via ICP OES. The Hearn, because of time, we'll just look at the Hearn right now for a pH change. We saw this profile fairly common across all three soils. We're still trying to look at the exact reason we have this depression right here around 550, 600 degrees. We believe it's on the mineralogy aspect. We're getting some unique things happening at the inner layers, both with regard to the destruction of some of the kaolinitic matrices as well as the 2:1s. The Rader and the Westwood had similar patterns. Obviously, the pH was different for those because they started out with different pHs. Excitement galore. When we came up with this initial work on the Hearn, this again was our surrogate soil for our grantor. We saw a complete loss of nitrogen. No surprise there. You start burning organic matter, a very sandy soil, modestly sandy soil to start with. We saw this unique aspect, increasing phosphorus with heating. And there's some research that suggests that as a liberation of organic phosphorus becomes quite available. We coupled that also with the fact that we saw a decrease in extractable calcium at that point. Possibly we're fusing calcium on these inner layers as we're increasing that temperature, and the phosphorus that had been associated as calcium phosphates is now available. We also saw an increase of potassium initially. However, like any good research study, you continue to look forward and you find out that your other soils do not respond at all like the other one. Again, we have here an ultisol, there being the Hearn, a vertisol, and then an alphasol. And what we see in that same phosphorus calcium difference here, steady decline in calcium with the Hearn. The Westwood, being a calcareous soil, all of a sudden starts liberating calcium. Then we start seeing a sequestration of that calcium, a huge bump, and we believe what this is right here, we're actually melting calcite at that point, and that calcite has become much more available. And then we have a suppression of it once again, a dropping off of it. Likely at 800 degrees, we've liquefied that, and it is becoming more molten, more crystalline, and the malic 3 is unable to extract that. At the same time, our phosphorus availability initially rises and then pretty much goes to highly unavailable levels. The Rader is similar to that, although the Rader did not see necessarily that loss of extractable calcium at higher temperatures, but it did see a significant decline in phosphorus availability at the higher temperatures. On the potassium side, we did have a net increase in the Hearn, as it was reported on the previous couple slides. The Westwood, highly fertile vertisol, increased potassium availability. Obviously, we're opening that inner layer in those smectitic clays, making them much more available. However, at these higher temperatures, one of two things is happening, and probably both are happening. There is good evidence that these elevated temperatures, potassium actually becomes airborne up in the 675, 700 degree and above temperatures. We've seen that work in our gasification work for biochar development. where we've seen significant, upwards of 75-80% loss of potassium. Whether that's happening here or that potassium is in that melted calcite type mineralogy, we're not quite certain on that. We are in the process of doing separation for clay mineralogy work. And the Raider, which started out with fairly modest to lower potassium levels, didn't see a lot of change in potassium extractability across the temperature regimes, but at these elevated temperatures, we did see that dramatic decline. Soil test analysis is a great starting point, but in the end, it's all about can we develop remediate these sites for plant development. So in a laboratory setting, as we're waiting on our grantor and other individuals to maybe get their act together to get the proper materials to us, we elected to do some laboratory quick and dirty growth aspects in these little cone containers. They're 24.5 millimeters by, should be 150 millimeters, apologize for that error. We chose nine different temperatures and maintained the water at appropriate rates. We looked at emergence, time of emergence, and then later development. Not a huge amount of change. Our surrogate soil was done in the foreign country. We found that was fairly similar. Seeing as I'm running out of time, I will speed up, but one of the things that we do is a lot of work with root development, where we actually extracted the cone material and washed the roots from that, did both root mass shoot aspects. Not a lot of difference in the oats or the soybeans that we did grow. From a conclusion, what we can say is that we saw an initial pH increase. The changes are relatively minimal compared to what we really thought based on other literature. Our changes in phosphorus and calcium levels are dependent upon heating, and most likely more dependent upon the mineralogy of the soil. Potassium availability initially increases, but then often decreases significantly at higher levels. I didn't report the micronutrient data here. However, universally, we saw an increase in iron, manganese, zinc, and copper, but those levels dramatically dropped with the increasing temperatures, particularly above 400 degrees C, to the point of reaching the detection limits of our methodology. Heating had no effect or minimal effects on oat or soybean emergence. And the minimal rooting mass differences were observed, but there was really no trend. So in short, it appears particularly for this client, and we're doing greenhouse work in addition to this, that the thermal desorption will not have any derogatory effects from a standpoint of using that to remove the hydrocarbons.
We have time for some questions, and then we'll be taking a break.
Hi, Lynn, you don't have a question there?
Why do you go to a 700, 800? Can you stop at 600? Is that the patient enough to remove hydrocarbons?
Well, we wanted to have a full dynamic range to see what's on the far extreme. And the other aspect is that the particular client we're dealing with, they're generally going to try to get below 550. However, the hydrocarbons that we're dealing with in that particular area, the spills started occurring in the 1940s, and we have a very, very high fraction. And if they need to go higher, even to a pyrolysis or a gasification level, potentially we need to go to those higher temperatures just to continue to do it that way, because we're limited in this rural area for energy. So if we're trying to do it more from a pyrolysis temperature standpoint, we're going to have to put energy in. We're hoping maybe we can just allow the hydrocarbons to burn at a higher level and not have that energy requirement.
But in reality, if there is 1 acre is contaminated, how do you hit the soil?
Well, it's more than an acre, Highland. In this particular location, estimates of 5 million cubic meters to a depth as deep as 20 feet. So it is going to be a huge... They've tried land farming. There's not enough land to farm. And it's also a xeric moisture regime, so they go from drought to tropical storms. It has to go very fast. So there is equipment for this, and they probably could process in the neighborhood of 1,000 cubic meters a day.